You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with the Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You've just been listening to Hot Texas with a Hot Texas Rhythm Band.
We are delighted to have you with us for episode 159. And if you are watching us streaming live on Facebook, Rendezvous with the Writer, or LA Talk Radio, or YouTube, we are so happy you're with us tonight. And if you're watching us later, thank you so much for picking this up and doing the replay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Jim, we have a full house tonight.
We have a full house tonight.
Who's with us tonight?
We have Janelle Maloney, we have Jane Little Bodkin, and we have Lynn Downing.
Yes, we have the Hottie Historian Collective back for episode, second episode this month. Isn't that fun?
Hottie Historian?
Yeah.
We'll have to talk about that.
Well, we will. Let's see. Let's say hello to Janelle Maloney first. Hello, Janelle, and where are you joining us from?
Hey, guys. I'm calling in from Ahwatukee, Arizona, so just south of Phoenix.
Very good.
Very good.
Very good.
You want to call out Jane's name and ask her where she's from?
And Jane, where are you calling in from? Where are you tonight?
We am in the White Mountain Wilderness in Lincoln County, New Mexico, just above Nogal.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
County.
And Lynn Downey is also with us. Hello, Lynn. And where are you joining us from tonight?
Hello, guys. I am joining you from my home in Sonoma, California, the real wine country.
Do you grow grapes?
I do. And for a while, I even won awards for it.
Oh, my God.
All right. I'm good.
You know, we learned a little something different.
Would you?
It's so fun. Well, a common theme running through all your writings is that strong women have always played impactful roles in history. Yet, their stories remain in the shadows. And tonight, we'll be talking about this thread running through all your work that we decided to title, ladies, right? Women Were There. So excited to get into greater depth of three different books that we're going to talk about tonight. So, Jim, you want to start with Janelle Maloney?
We have a little bio here. Janelle Maloney, national award-winning author, news journalist, and the original Hottie Historian. She hosts the Women of Wyoming Then and Now interview series and writes about women, wars, and the West. Recently, she has been credited with pinpointing Wyatt Earp's first gunfight. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Talking tonight about the book Emigrant Tales of the Platte River Raids. What a read. Janelle, you want to tell us a little bit about the book?
Yeah, that one actually contains three Civil War battles that have never been discovered before because the military accounts were a little bit biased and censored, but the emigrants traveling on the trail tell it all. And a lot of those stories from the emigrants are from women, the diarists, the letters home, or the records that they later produce, not from the guys. So I think that's really special that women documented it first, really, and it's women who get to put all of that out there. And before we get too far, as a reminder, the haughty historian thing, oh my gosh, that's just because one time I got teased a little bit about being the haughty historian. And I said, you know what? That's right. I am. And I trademarked it. And I have invited some of my best friends to come along for the fun.
It is very, very fun. You know, one thing that amazed me too about this book, of course, it's just so very, very thorough. Not only do you cover how many wagons and souls were on the trail at the time, and you give us all of that, and then you pull out their stories. And so this is just a remarkable read, and I highly recommend it to readers of all interest levels, no matter what you have an interest in the West. You need to read Janelle's book. Okay, now we're going to move on to Jane Botkin. Hello, Jane, and welcome.
Thank you.
We have a little bio. National award-winning author Jane Little Botkin melds personal narratives of American families with compelling stories of Western women. A member of Western Writers of America since 2017, she judges entries for the WWE's prestigious Spur Award, reviews new releases, and writes articles for various magazines. She is a two-time Spur Award winner herself. Very good.
Welcome, Jane. And tonight we're talking about a book that's not quite out yet, but I am going to hold up another book of yours about a strong woman who was there. And this is The Girl Who Dared to Define, Jane Street and the Rebel Maids of Denver, which we'll have to have you back on another time, to Jane, to talk about some of your other work. But tell us about what we're going to talk about tonight.
Tonight, we're going to talk about Mary Ann Goodnight. I have a biography coming out now. The University of Oklahoma Press is going to produce it now, February, March of 2027. I thought it was going to be just a year from now, but I've got to wait 15 months, which is painful. But they have the book, so I'm excited. I decided to write this story after going to the Goodnight Ranch House site, the Charles and Mary Ann Goodnight Historic Site. And after going through, I asked a docent, well, actually, she was from the Panhandle Plains Museum, I think, I think it's where she was from, but she was a scholar. And this was the part that bothered me. And I just simply asked at the time, are there any books written on Mary Ann Goodnight? She said, nope. There's only this much information. Nobody's written it. And so that was my challenge. I was born about an hour away from this place. That is actually my roots originally. And so I just got engrossed in the story. And it's, oh my goodness, it's been addictive research.
I'm sure. So, of course, we have to ask this question whenever there's a biography involved. If you had the opportunity to sit down with Mary Ann Goodnight, do you have a burning question that you would want to ask her?
You know, her, every time, even as she got in her elderly years, she had a favorite story she'd always tell. And that was the first time that she descended into Palo Duro Canyon and living there. She lived on a fabulous ranch. Actually, she had two wonderful homes, and the last one was a fabulous ranch. But her favorite time was living in a cabin, a solitary home on the bottom of Palo Duro Canyon within 100 miles. And I'd want to ask her why. What made that particular place so special?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what a great question. All right, now we're on to Lynn Downey. Jim, tell us a little bit about Lynn.
Lynn Downey is an award-winning historian, novelist, and short story writer. She was the Levi Strauss & Company's historian for 25 years and wrote the definitive biography of the company's founder, Levi Strauss, the man who gave blue jeans to the world.
And Lynn, tonight we're talking about American Dude Ranch, A Touch of the Cowboy, and The Thrill of the West. Tell us a little bit about how this book came to be.
Well, I got really interested in the history of dude ranching when I was the Levi's historian, because they had an entire line of clothing in the 1930s called Dude Ranch Duds. And it was jeans and satin shirts and gabardine riding pants and this amazing stuff that no real cowboy would wear. But a few years after I left the company, I realized that dude ranching showed up in so many aspects of American culture, and nobody had written a really definitive history of dude ranching since about 1980 something. So I thought, well, I guess it's time for me to do mine. Just like you need to write Marianne Goodnight, it's time for that book to be written. So I did a lot of research. I got some research travel grants and some research fellowships, and had a blast.
And it's a blast to read. Such a fun book to read. So let's see. We were talking about Levi's as wardrobe. So what about Dudine's that didn't wear Levi's?
I'm so glad you asked me that. Because one of the amazing women I write about in my book is Sally Rand, who was a fan dancer, which is a nice way of saying stripper. And in 1936, she debuted a show called Sally Rand's Nude Ranch at the Fort Worth Centennial in 1936, and it brought it to the 1939 World's Fair in San Francisco. And in my personal collection, I happen to have the program, I don't know if you can see this, of Sally Rand's Nude Ranch. And she's just fascinating. She loved the West. She ended up marrying a cowboy, Turk Greenoff. They had a ranch in Montana. She's just a fascinating person. And she once came to the Levi's headquarters in San Francisco to look out a wardrobe for herself.
Oh, cool. So she came clothed, obviously, or she left clothed.
Both.
Good one. My goodness, this is so much fun. We are so delighted to have the three of you with us. We're going to break away for just a moment and ask you a question. Are you a writer? Our sponsors, Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, are standing by to assist you just as they assist us. Here's exciting news about a feature offered to writers. And when we come back, Janelle is going to share a passage from her book. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Authors, welcome home. Every author needs a website, a home base for their brand. Professionally showcase your books and brand with a custom website landing page starting at $369. Bluebookshelf.com. It's a great feeling to be home. Contact the Blue Cottage team today to get started.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer. Special night tonight, we have several guests. Janelle Maloney, Jane Little-Bodkin, and Lynn Downey. And we're holding up Janelle's book, and she's going to read a little bit from it.
Yes. Go, Janelle, set it up and read to us.
Perfect. So earlier you had mentioned women that were kind of left in the shadows. And so I'm going to read a selection from the book that features Mary Ringo, who's Johnny Ringo's mom, and America Forbis, who's one of the first female settlers when she gets to where she gets to in Montana. And we're talking about July 29 to 30. This is after the Platte River raids. And we know, or if you've gotten into any of the OK Corral stuff, Johnny Ringo, his father dies in this event, and it was because they were all stressed out. Well, yeah, they're traveling through. They see burned wagons. They see carcasses of various animals and humans, and they're devastated. And then they get attacked two times in the same night. And so here's what happens. The ladies really show the tenderness of that moment, even when they're scared, and how that affects little Johnny at 14 years old. So on the night of the 29th, that evening, the Ringo Company camps between Deer Creek and Little Box Elder Creek. America writes, one of our party was shot by an Indian that had crept amongst into the circle without being discovered by the guards. Mary writes, about dark, Mr. Ravel went out to bring in his horses when a man shot him through the arm. In short time, all lights were extinguished and every man to his post, expecting to be attacked by the Indians. And then they are going the opposite direction of a woman who was kidnapped, and now she's back home safely, but she's headed the other way, and everyone's on edge. Sarah Larimer writes,
When en route to Fort Laramie the second afternoon, July 29, our encampment was in an extensive grove, and while some of our men were rambling about, several shots were fired at them. This is Sarah Larimer's family shooting against the Ringo Company, who had just also been attacked. Supposing this an attack by Indians, they returned the fire, causing quite a sensation in camp. Fortunately, the timber proved a shield and no one was injured. The invaders were travelers belonging to an emigrant train corralled just beyond the woods. They were en route for the Pacific coast, and with it were some aged persons and many children. Fearing another robbery or another attack, Martin Ringo and all other men in the Ringo Company are exhausted on the morning of the 30th from double guard shifts all through the night. America writes, males, young and old, had guard duty to perform. And this fatigue is what takes a tragic toll on the Ringo family. Mr. Rushville wrote, most of us had been up the entire night watching for an Indian attack. And just as day dawn began to streak the east, myself with others were standing against our wagons, listening at the crack of every bush around us. Mary, and now, O God, comes the saddest record of my life. For this day, my husband accidentally shot himself. Martin was buried by the wayside, and oh, my heart is breaking. My little children are crying all the time. What am I to do? At this point, she's 6 months pregnant with 5 children. And then America writes, speaking of what do you do, Mary? America says, I recall an instance when a mere boy, Johnny Ringo, was standing night guard at the wagon next to mine. He was so exhausted by the heat and fatigue of the day's travel that he would fall asleep at his post. And at intervals through the night, his watchful mother would arouse him from a gentle call from the wagon. She did not sleep that night, but she kept watch in place of her boy and awakened him only when she feared he would be discovered neglecting his duty. His father was killed only a few nights previous while on guard duty at the same wagon. And that is a woman literally in the shadows raising up this boy to end up being quite a colorful character in the Wild West, but she never gave up no matter what.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's remarkable that the women were writing, you know, and they're writing so, you know, so elegant, so well. And so you just are right there with them. And you think about their writing tools and in the dark and how they, you know, how were they able to do that? They did. You all have experiences of research of working with primary documents. And how that's not even a question. That's just a comment. It's just amazing to me. Do either of you have a question for Janelle? Let's have writer to writer. What would you like to ask Janelle? Jane, you have a question?
I'm just curious how you found all this. How did you get the information?
Well, I was wondering about that of, is it really that much harder to find women's accounts? Well, maybe in a general library format. I think Lynn could speak more to that. But for me, it was through social networking. I found the one diary and I'd say all the names in it. I'd reach out to those people online and say, hey, I think we have something in common. Would you be willing to talk to me? And that is just, I think, very unique to women, that that's the way we work. And women keep those records. They're not public. They're not published. They're still in a box or scrapbook. But when women communicate and say, we have this shared experience, the door was open wide and resources poured out. And I'm so thankful to the many, many women who contributed to this story.
Wow. Lynn, you have a question or comment for Janelle?
I just wanted to say that's absolutely true. You know, if you think about the book that came out, gosh, 40 or more years ago now, The Midwife's Tale, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, who found this diary of this 18th century midwife from Maine that had been at the Maine Historical Society for decades. Nobody thought it was worth anything or of any interest to anyone. And she decided to take it out of its box and use it. And she wrote a Pulitzer Prize winning book. And it really put women's diaries on the map. And it really put this idea that when women historians jump in to look for their stories in the archives, they're going to find them and they're going to make something amazing out of them.
Yeah. I think that is the whole issue, is that nobody was interested in women's stories. Right. Men dominated. And so all of the literature, I also do use letters and things like that. And I also went on Ancestry and found family relatives and things like that. And because the men, it was a men's world. And that's exactly what I was up against too, as well, in my research on this particular topic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Janelle, did you travel to any of the places that you write about? Did you go and look?
Oh yeah, I road tripped on the road and off road on both sides of the trail. Took lots and lots of pictures. I had local people also help me get access to private land. So I saw some things nobody else knows about, but that was really important to see. Like, you think, okay, these diaries line up. I think the Larimers and the Ringos are actually shooting at each other. But when you stand there and you do the mileage and you're like, oh my gosh, yes, they really are. They're right there. And all that's between them is trees, but it's friendly fire. But everyone's so scared. But you can see it. It's better when you can see it for yourself. Lynn or Jane, have you traveled to some of the locations in your books?
Always walk the story. Yeah, absolutely. Always. That's essential.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Boots on the ground research.
Yep. Yeah. Always. You have to walk it. You have to see have to see the context in which you're writing. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter where it is. You have to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Janelle, my last question for you might be, you have some family members that you write about. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Family that. So did you uncover something that was a surprise, or did you learn things you hadn't known, or did you find that solidified, you know, what you'd heard, or what was that like to research your family on this?
My family? Well, my family, the diary had been published in 1954 with errors in it, and many people had been writing about Sarah Rousseau's 1864 diary for about 20 years, coming up with conclusions based on a flawed document. And so when I was getting into it, I was frustrated and confused, and I'm looking at my document, which is the original, saying, she didn't say that, she didn't do that. So I thought, it was really special to be able to clarify that and get her words to actually be her words and get them out there correct once and for all.
Jim, you have been totally quiet. Jim, you have you to know, jump in here.
I think it's amazing. You have so many names of the folks that were on the wagons. I almost asked myself, is there a master list someplace where all these names go down? Because yeah. I would think every once in a while somebody slip on a wagon, that name would never get recorded.
Here's the master list, right?
Yes. And I thought at some point I found everyone, except there was, there's a family that's hunting down John Brown's family on the trail, and they want to kill John Brown's wife and children. And I never identified who that was until a year after the fact. And finally made the connection. And it was one of those, if I had just looked at one more thing, it was right there. And I didn't get to it until a year later. But now I know.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, we're going to take another very short break. And we're going to step away for just a moment, because we know all of you listening and watching want the books of these three authors tonight. And you can find them on the Out West Shop affiliate page on bookshop.org. And when we come back, Jane will share a passage from The Breath of a Buffalo, a biography of Mary Ann Goodnight. Here's a word about Out West Shop Bookshop. We'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer, Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Running With the Writer. We had several people on.
Oh, it's so fun.
Janelle Maloney. Jane Littlebotkin. Lynn Downey. And I think Jane.
Yes.
Is going to be the passage.
Yes, here's Jane Littlebotkin. Take it away, Jane.
Well, you know what? When you introduced me, I always just assume everybody knows who Marianne Goodnight is. I mean, in Texas, we all know for sure, and they know in Colorado. Marianne Goodnight is the person responsible for the Southern Plains bison herd not becoming extinct, and also contributed to the Northern herd, simply because she sold or sent or donated bison up to Montana. And so, yes, she's the Goodnights did that. And so, and as a statistic, in the year, let's say 1870, there were about 30 million bison in the United States. And they were really all the same bison, bison, bison. It didn't matter if it was north, if it was north, south, until the Transcontinental Railroad cut them in half. In just 10 years later, there was less than 500. And that's just a stark figure. And who was Charles Goodnight? Her husband. And who was Charles Goodnight? He was the most famous cattle driver. And even though this is just a kind of a vague rendition of him, but if you watch Lonesome Dove, Captain Call is based on Charles Goodnight. And so, you know, without a wife. So I'm excited to read this to you. This will set up a little bit about what I was explaining, why I wanted to do that challenge. Why in the world didn't somebody tell Mary's story because of what she contributed? And the problem is that it was the man's story all this time and no one looked at Mary. So this is the prologue. And I'm going to read that. And I know, Bobby Jean, you've already read this. I've got my husband's glasses on. Prologue. 1877. And I'm in the middle of this continuum with these ladies here. Janelle is Old West. My book is Old West going into New West. And Lynn is going to top us off with New West. And so I like this transition really well. Ponderous clouds hindered Marianne Goodnight's view of a grand abyss plummeting just beyond her toes. The weather hadn't dissuaded Mary, at least not yet. For over a year, she had anticipated when she, along with her husband Charlie, would enter Palo Duro Canyon and move into their new ranch headquarters in the heart of the Texas Panhandle. And now she was here. Mary's brothers and other cowboys had been preparing for the couple's arrival for months, cutting timber, building roads, and erecting a new two-room cedar log cabin for the couple. But Mary couldn't discern any improvements from atop the canyon. Peering over the rim, all she could glimpse were small pockets of cedars and various hardwoods emerging from the toes of chalky white rock formations, now darkening into dull, ugly grays. The journey from Trinidad, Colorado, beginning late spring, had been tedious. Four slow-moving mule-drawn wagons hauled 6 months of ranch supplies and household goods behind 100 plodding Durham bulls, the best-blooded Charlie could buy. Across New Mexico's and Texas's high plains, Mary, likely wearing a man's wide-brimmed hat, had driven a mule team too. Alongside his mistress's specially outfitted light ambulance trotted Mary's gated saddle horse, Patty. There had been feminine company as well. Cornelia, wife of Charlie Goodnight's new aristocratic Irish partner, John G. Adair, split time atop a white gelding and riding in the ambulance with Mary. Cornelia, usually fearless, had been nervous along the way, or at least her husband had been, as a contingent of federal troops sent by the United States War Department arrived to ensure that Cornelia, daughter of the late General James S. Wadsworth and her supercilious husband, reached their destination along with their lives. After initially reaching the canyon, Charlie left the high-grade bulls with Mary's brothers to herd down a rough trail to a narrow valley where the animals would be self-contained. Then the little procession traveled 3 more days southeast, following the upper canyon's rim until finally halting on a great mesa directly above what would be known as the Old Home Ranch. Below, a large park held about 1,000 to 1,500 grazing bison.
Whoa.
Now, with intermittent rain and a sunless sky hung low, rolls of mist swept through the gorges, blocking Mary's view. She could only imagine the steep hills covered with cedar, chin oak piling down the cliffy walls to the creek, and the new cabin with a spring from which she could draw her water. Later, Charlie would write that that night was that was about to follow was one I shall never forget. A summer thunderstorm cracked lightning and unfamiliar noises thundered below as thousands of hooves tumbled rocks, uprooting and crushing scrub cedars. Terrified by the new sounds that surged from the canyon's maw, hoarse, incessant rumbles from the throats of thousands of buffaloes, Mary panicked. She fled to her ambulance, pulling the wagon sheet over her head. Mary screamed to her husband that the buffaloes would overrun her wagon, that it would be torn apart. Frustrated, Charlie shouted through the pandemonium that the buffaloes were now miles away and that it was the atmospheric conditions and the canyon's reverberations that made the roaring seem so near. But in his words, his explanation utterly failed in convincing her. Then it began to rain, the downpour terrific, and the sky one blaze of light. Rain pelted on the wagon sheet over Mary's head, and she could see thousands of flashes through the canvas covering, even as the thunder grew more intense. There was no child's play in counting seconds between light and sound. Each lightning strike cracked the sky open like a shattered urn, unleashing torrents of rain. Deciding that the darkness was also distressing Mary, Charlie built a great fire of dry cedar, assuring her that no buffalo would be easier turned by a light than by a cavalry regiment. Only then was his wife calmed. The night had been terrifying and memorable. And surely Mary never would have believed that it marked the beginning of the most extraordinary part of her life, leaving all marks and traces of civilization behind in Colorado. The first lady of the Palo Duro Canyon would set up a house in a chasm 1,500 feet deep, 10 miles wide, and nearly 100 miles long without another white woman within 200 miles in any direction. Even more significant, Mary Ann Goodnight would lose her fear of the great beast that shook Palo Duro Canyon's walls, and in doing so, help save an entire species from extinction. Now, that is taken, much of that verbiage is right from Charles Goodnight's words and Mary's. And this is this and her nieces, who she told the story to. And this is her favorite memory. Is this right here that she will tell until she's 88 years old when she has dementia and she can't remember anything else. But she tells this story. And of that, those 1,500 bison, 1 year later, not even 1 year later, 6 months later, Charles Goodnight, who talked about saving bison and all this later, he actually hired a buffalo hunter to come in and kill every one of them.
They came
in and shot him because the animals were encroaching on the grazing grass that he wanted for his cattle. And what would happen would be one morning she would wake up in May 15th, actually 1878. So it was just a year later. She would wake up and she'd listen to a bison calf's cries all night long. And she didn't complain about it. She asked about it. And his gut response, being a man, was, told her brother, go find it and shoot it. Because that's, you know, these babies couldn't live without their moms, and they couldn't climb up these cliffs or escape when these buffalo hunters were killing them, the parents, you know. And she said, oh, no, you will not. It stops now. And she said, bring the calf to me. And so she gave birth to a bison herd, basically is what she did. And his words were, well, you know, she was stressed out and, you know, I wanted to make her happy, so to speak. You know, I knew she was anxious over this. So I thought, okay, we'll just go collect these calves for her. Keep her busy. Boy, did it. So.
You know, at this time period, didn't white people eat buffalo meat?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Wonder why you want to kill them all off.
No. I can tell you that right now. When Mary first came to Texas was in 1854. She hadn't even seen a bison before until she got into Ellis County on the Blackland County near Trinity River. There were so many bison that you could ride 20 miles through a herd. Wow. A train would have to wait. But the problem was, and of course the frontiersmen definitely knew that buffalo meat was good, but you know who else depended on the buffalo were the Native Americans. When they put through that Transcontinental Railroad, the first one, which was a year after your story, Janelle, the first Transcontinental Railroad actually left Nebraska and it cut through the lower part of your Powder Basin and then went on across. It split the herd in two. It caused the Sioux, the Lakotas, and everybody else to get the Plains Indians to get really upset.
Livid.
And it wasn't just within, that was in 1863, they started that construction. And in 1870, they completed the second Transcontinental Railroad, which actually went from Kansas and cut right across into Denver. And once again, it cut these herds so much. So that's how you got the Northern herd and the Southern herd. And the Native Americans with those trains came railway stations, and stopovers where, you know, the train would stop to get the water or the coal or whatever. And it just brought people in. And of course the government had a secondary reason, you know, they didn't want the Native Americans. And when Mary and Charles set up house the first time, they were in Comancheria, which was the Comanches' historic native lands. And it covered a lot of Texas, all the way up into the Arkansas River in Colorado. So, it's a terrific story that this Native American thread weaves through this, because the reason that Mary Ann Dyer, Goodnight, came to Texas as Mary Ann Dyer was because her father made a pledge to Sam Houston, "If you get me out of Tennessee, I promise every one of my boys will be soldiers in your army." It was a blood promise. And he was an Indian agent at Fort Belknap. And that's exactly what got started, were these frontier awful wars. And it's funny, if it's the Comanches killing the whites in the North Texas, it's a massacre. And if it's the white men killing the Indians, it's a incident. It's real interesting. But that plays a big part in this book. Yeah.
Well, Jane, thank you so much. We can't wait for this book to come out. Thank you. Oh, my goodness. And the way you write it, we're just right there. Just fabulous. Normally, we would take another break, but I'm just looking at time, and we want to also be sure to have. Now we're just going to shift a little away from Jane, and we're going to go right with Lynn Downey. And Lynn, let's see, did you want to read a little something aloud from your book?
I do. I just have a short preface, which is to say that one of the things I really enjoyed in my research about dude ranching was how involved women were with this new industry. And so many husband and wife couples owned dude ranches, and the woman was always called the dude ranch wife. And there was a little bit of a, you know, split in terms of who did what duties. But if the wrangler was sick and the husband was out of town, the woman would lead the, you know, the trail rides. And if, you know, somebody needed an extra, somebody wait staff, the husband would come and, you know, help hand out food. So it was a real equal partnership in this. But there were also women who owned dude ranches on their own. And I want to read to you about one of them. Her name was Helen Brooke Herford. Okay. She was born on her family's ranch near the Muscle Shell River north of Billings. The family was well off and sent Helen to school in Massachusetts and Germany, but she came back to Montana to teach and work on the ranch. In 1929, she and her cousin, Helen Underwood Wellington, formed a partnership and opened the Swinging H Dude Ranch near Limestone in Stillwater County. Helen was an outspoken, fearless woman who worked right alongside her hands, fixing fence, cleaning ditches, halter breaking colts, in addition to leading trail rides and multi-day pack trips. She wrote promotional essays about what it was like to run the ranch, especially as a woman. And she especially enjoyed writing about the girls who visited the Swinging H. In one essay titled "With Only One Woman," she described taking a group of socially prominent young women in her car on a muddy, treacherous road to visit a sheep camp. She also enjoyed watching them exchanging their Eastern clothes for jeans and spending their days riding, visiting nearby ranches, fishing, writing letters, and shooting with both a gun and a camera. They told her they'd had the best time of their lives. Helen understood the importance of wearing the right clothes on the ranch, and in April of 1934, she wrote to Levi Strauss & Co. in San Francisco, suggesting they make jeans that would fit women. She had worn men's jeans all her life, but knew that a more feminine style would appeal to her non-Western guests. She also wanted a better-fitting product for herself. The national sales manager at Levi's responded to her letter and said that they were already working on a women's version of the jeans and would send her a pair once they came out of the factory. The Lady Levi's, the very first jeans ever for women, by the way, arrived in June, and Helen made a few comments about the fit in a series of lively letters she sent to the company over the course of 1934. The firm sent her another pair in November, and she wrote back to say that she liked the pants very much, except for one thing. Have heard much praise for the women's jeans and only one complaint, that they have not as many buttons on the placket as the men's. Now, this is not a small thing. For women Connecticut and New York to go to Montana and wear jeans was revolutionary because there's no way these women could wear denim back home, not even just to go shopping. We're talking the 30s here and even into the 1950s. So these women could wear jeans for the first time. Some of these women, especially in the early years, this is the first time they ever wore rode a horse that wasn't side saddle. These women wore jeans and straddled a horse. This is eye-opening for them. This is one of the reasons that women went west, is because they could strip away social norms. They could be their interior selves. They could never be at home. And the Dude Ranch gave that to women. And that's probably my favorite part of the whole story.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking, we have to talk about ladies riding side saddle because you know I think how do you do that?
I don't know.
Well, falling off, I can't stay on a horse very well as it is.
That's all right.
Go ahead.
I was going to say Charles Goodnight invented a better side saddle that women rode. He was the first one to design it for Mary, and a saddle maker did it. Yeah.
That's fascinating. So, ladies, do you have a question for Lynn?
I do, because you were mentioning the way that a Dude Ranch makes a woman feel, and I imagine now I've only been to a couple of ranches because I think horses smell bad. But I imagine there is still that same kind of nostalgia of, but it's different. Like they feel free. They feel wild. Or what is that that you see women today still love that feeling that a Dude Ranch gives them?
I think it's not even just women, but both women and men. There's a sense that you leave the modern world behind when you go to a Dude Ranch. And Dude Ranches today have just as modern activities as any of them. I know desert ranches that offer electric bikes and you can play tennis or go swimming or whatever, but the core of the Dude Ranch is the horse. And sometimes women might not have as much of an opportunity back home to ride, and they love to ride. And the great thing about a Dude Ranch is that the wranglers have to be so skilled, they have to ask every single guest about their riding experience. And you better not say that you're a better rider than you are, because you're going to get a
weight
like, you know, gunpowder or something, and then you're really going to fall off. But I think there's a sense for women that there's that freedom that comes with riding a horse that has never gone away. And a Dude Ranch will offer that to women.
Yeah.
I think that's always going to be there.
Yes. Yeah, Jane.
It's the first time I have ever put the two and two together about the fashion aspect with a Dude Ranch, because I'm thinking more like what you just described. But when you talked about not having the rivets on the jeans, and I started thinking about the scarves that we bid on at some of our Western Riding of America auctions and things. Mm-hmm. Well, of course. And I think that's what I would, I love to ride, Janelle. I do. But I think I would really have gotten into that, and leave it to you, because you worked with Levi, to know that about that fashion aspect with this. Wow. That would have been a great period. Yeah. I would have loved that. Yeah.
In 1935, Vogue magazine had an issue with a big article about Dude Ranching. And it had an entire section about the proper thing to wear at a Dude Ranch. And it had this incredible drawing of these two women in jeans and boots and hats and this, you know, a great free air of bravado. And that's a quote. That is how you wear jeans and satin rodeo shirts, is with that air of bravado. And so Vogue got into that as well.
And would you tell the origin of the word dude for the audience?
There you go.
Mm-hmm. How much time do you have?
yeah. The, 1 minute.
okay. In the late 1880s, the West was becoming less wild and men were becoming more civilized. And the word dude is a very old English word that actually meant clothing. It's where we get the word duds. But in the 1880s, where men were being a little too feminized in New York City, you know, and back East, a man who was a dude was a man who wasn't quite a man. And those were the kind of people who were originally coming to these ranches. And so the word at first was, these are the kind of guys. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt was called a dude once when he went to a ranch in North Dakota. But eventually, the word meant just a stranger. It just meant someone from another place who wanted to come out west. So it started off being a pejorative and ended up being a compliment.
Like a soft cowboy.
That's right. That's right. And you're a woman, you're a dudeen.
Okay, we need to know. We're going to now ask everybody. So Lynn, starting with you, where do we find you and where do we get your book?
You can find me at lynndowney.com. You can email me to get copies of my book, certainly bookshop.org. And probably, if I'm lucky, the bookshop at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West in Cody.
Very good. Okay. And Janelle, what about you? Tell us how we find you.
I'm all over social media at author Janelle Maloney, or check out the website, janellemaloney.com, or check out the YouTube. If you can't spell my name, just type in Haughty Historian and it'll all come up for you very easily.
Amazing.
There's a real reason. That's smart. Yeah. And Jane, how do we find and follow you?
I'm on social media as well. My website is janelittlebotkin.com. My books can be found just about anywhere, but bookshop.org is obviously a very great place. The University of Oklahoma Press, Barnes & Noble's, always Amazon. But it's nicer if you can get these from these independent bookstores. It's always better.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I forgot social media, but I'm there too. And I have, before we go, I have to tell Jim that I love that shirt. That's a great shirt.
Thank you.
We're actually both in Rockmount. He's in embroidery and I'm in a Day of the Dead skeletons dancing all over one of their prints.
It was a big decision tonight. See, I was going to wear my skull shirts because tomorrow's Halloween. And Bob said, no, we're not going to wear skull shirts today, even though you got skulls on yours.
Because anyway, you know.
Thank you.
We always are doing the last minute. You wouldn't think last minute, but the secret is out. We are last minute. We are so happy that you were all with us tonight. And to have you a second time is just, you know, how special is that we had you twice this month? So, thank you. You gave us a lot of time. We had pre-interviews. We had all kinds of emails. And we really, really want to thank you for all being with us. And we want to thank Sam Hassan of LA Talk Radio and the Hot Texas Swing Band. We want to thank Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison. We're, of course, thanking all of you for being with us. And next week, we have two friends joining us, actually kicking off November, the first Thursday of every month. Henry Park joins us. Henry C. Park, film editor and author, film editor for True West Magazine. We always kick off the month. Henry gives us the latest roundup of what's going on in Western film and TV. And then we have a sci-fi author friend. And this will be fun. Richard Polinelli is an award-winning sci-fi writer. He and I were co-hosts for a number of years on The Writer's Block. And it's delightful to catch up with Richard. He has just written is a space detective noir title of all the gin joints in the universe.
Wow.
Imagine what happens. This is really fun. I am
Mike Hammer.
Yeah, a little Mike Hammer, a little bit dressed, a little fedora in the future. Really fun. So join us for that next week. And do you have any parting thoughts?
Yeah, again, thank you all for the show.
Thank you for having us.
It's really fun.
And as we always say, it's always a great day out west.
Keep writing.
We'll keep reading.
We'll keep reading. See you down the trail. See you.
Thank you.
Thank you.